because they don't have to be approved by Congress. Justin Elliott, reporter at ProPublica, will link to your pieces. Meet the hundreds of officials Trump has quietly installed across the government. That does it for the program. We have an amazing group that came in on this snowy day. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gutisdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura. Thanks so much to Julie Crosby and Paul Huckabee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Abe and Joe Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their Eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Good morning.
Hey,
this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show here at KBOO 90.7 FM dial here in Portland. I'm Joe. Abe ain't here. I'm not replacing him, but a special guest, Professor David Horowitz from Portland State, who recently was involved in a discussion with faculty members and students at Portland State, talking just in general about what's going on, what needs to happen, what is not happening. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say, Joe.
And it was interestingly well received. I thought it might be useful to briefly recount some of the struggles that have taken place in America. And when I say struggles, I'm talking about stuff that is not generally made available, made to be understood in the lives of ordinary people, particularly in the educational system of our country, which is fundamentally, and this is important, conservative, if not reactionary. And I really believe that. David may not, but I have a very dark view, and David will make me feel better. That's your job.
I have a sunny disposition, I was told in kindergarten.
I think it's probably true. I have a dark disposition. I was also told that in kindergarten. But I flunked first grade.
You did.
I actually flunked first grade. In the New York public school system, New York City, they held me, you know, they had semesters that were real. and they held me behind after the first semester of first grade.
I didn't do very well in kindergarten.
I bet you were a crayon nightmare.
I couldn't master the manual dexterity.
Oh, that's interesting. I never knew you were a klutz. I always been a klutz. No, but I had very mean teachers. And this, of course, was during the last days of World War II and into the new world, the post-war period, as it's called, which was actually a protracted economic and propaganda war that went on and on and on until the collapse of the Soviet Union. And now, hey, the Russians are back. Yay! Here's what's going to happen. David, I'm going to ask David to talk a little, just very briefly, about the history of American struggles in America for equality and progressive ideas, and the reactions there too. And you all out there will benefit by his wisdom or not. And then we're going to, I might say something, but then we're going to open it up for all of you. So I'm hoping you'll be patient and listen a little bit. I should, full disclosure, David and I first met in 1968. Oh my God.
That's right.
That's really true. And I was going back to school after various adventures, going to graduate school, and Portland State had just become a university. And I was being given money first by the sociology department and then later by the urban studies program. And I ended up getting a master's and a PhD. And David, meanwhile, went on to fame and fortune with numerous books and an actual full professorship, a tenured position of great esteem. Esteem. I like to say that about your work.
After almost failing tenure.
Did you almost fail tenure?
Oh, yeah. They postponed it for a year.
Because I didn't know that. What did you do wrong?
My classroom disruption during the Portland State strike.
Ah. Yeah. Yeah. You lucky you didn't get busted.
Yep. I did.
You got arrested?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It was a misdemeanor, $100 fine. Nick Chabot was my defense attorney.
Oh, Nick Chabot. I miss him.
But he was busy with Kent Ford, so he didn't really prepare for my defense.
No, and I can understand that. I think the issues of the Black Panthers at that time were very important.
Yeah.
Okay, so give us all a kind of really brief history thing.
One more thing, the David Horowitz qualification. I'm not David J. Horowitz, who's an advisor to Donald Trump.
You mean the bad David Horowitz?
My evil twin, yes.
I know him. I mean, I knew him. I don't know him.
I met him too, yeah.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
So what I was trying to do at this panel, which is about protest riots and social movements, and the organizers wanted some sort of context from a historian about social movements in American life. And I've been teaching U.S. political and cultural history, as Joe said, since 1968. So I have a lot of time to think about these things and to kind of get some sort of sense of what makes sense.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you. Do you remember I used to yell at you down the hall?
Yeah.
When we both were in the history department. And I was actually teaching parallel to you.
Yeah.
With a somewhat different perspective. But anyway, go ahead.
So what I've sort of learned is that social movements that may percolate up from the grassroots don't normally succeed without some sort of involvement and input from not just the middle class, but very often from vested interests. And going back to the labor movement in the early 20th century, when it was mainly the American Federation of Labor or the garment workers' unions, both of these movements really needed middle class reformers to kind of give them cover and give them legitimacy, whereas the industrial workers of the world was out there on their own and became victimized by government repression during World War I and during the Red Scare that followed it. It's just really important to build those alliances.
This is a pragmatic statement.
This is a pragmatic statement. The same with the women's suffrage movement. Now, there, some of the alliances were pretty disreputable in terms of our own values. But the suffrage movement in the progressive years before World War I adopted an insider strategy, which meant middle-class women wanted to assure middle-class white men that they would be reliable partners in protecting social purity and protecting the country's kind of ethno-cultural foundation.
Wait a minute. Social purity?
Yeah, purity reform, like anti-prostitution, like prohibition. The Mann Act of 1910, which prohibited transporting a woman across state lines for immoral purposes. The anti-abortion anti-contraception. This was all part of the so-called Purity Crusade, which is part of progressive reform. Basically, women's suffrage, I think most people know this now, refused to set up coalitions with African-American women's organizations in the South because the calculation was we can't get the votes of Southern senators for a constitutional amendment if we bring in the race issue. And so they abandoned black women. And in a sense, even abandoned to a certain extent working class second generation immigrant women. It worked. They got suffrage. I'm not putting that forth as a positive model, but I'm saying that movements that succeed often make compromises, even compromises we might find offensive. And if you look at the CIO industrial labor movement of the 1930s, which used the sit-down tactic, which was a radical tactic that mm-hmm. the industrial workers of the world had first used back in 1912, essentially the CIO unions wound up empowering white and black working class Americans as citizens of a consumer democracy. Essentially, the CIO opted for deferring to management on production priorities and what gets produced and management of the shop floor in return for very good benefits, including wage benefits and sometimes health and pension benefits. So the CIO wound up becoming, cooperating in a sense with the industrial elite to provide a quality of life to its workers and became interested in that. And of course, the early civil rights movement is another example, talking about up to 1965, which basically was articulated, not just by Reverend King, but by others, as embodying evangelical Christianity, the notions of the dignity of every person, the notions of American exceptionalism, you know, that America is a special place and that its culture is enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. And as many scholars are now pointing out, part of the reason that conservatives supported the early civil rights legislation, like the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, was to enhance America's reputation in the Cold War as a country that was democratic. You can see that even in Eisenhower's speech when he sends troops to Little Rock to integrate Little Rock High School. So what I'm saying there is the early civil rights movement articulated its goals in terms of very basic American values modernizing the archaic social system of the South was no threat to American national values. In fact, it was part of bringing the South into the national marketplace. The South had changed a great deal since the 1930s with government agencies for agriculture reform and also for corporations, industrial corporations.
And of course, the creation of rural electric
yeah,
service.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think things that didn't work were elements of the anti-Vietnam War movement, which I was a part of, the Black Panthers. These were movements that seemed geared more to their constituents' needs than the need to express cohesion in the national culture. And that was sort of my point, that social movements have to get beyond themselves and to address what most Americans would see as the national interest. If you're opposing a war, to oppose it because you're a pacifist and don't believe, you know, in the use of violence as an instrument of national policy, that's fine, but that's not necessarily going to appeal to a general public which has concerns about security, national security. You always have to articulate the goals in terms of the interests of the general public because it is an electoral democracy, as faulted as it is. What I was trying to say was that I thought there were three tools for social change, and it's essential to have a country where people are striving for social change and have a vision, but they would good lawyers, a strong social movement to frame public opinion and sustain the morale of your own people, and political mobilization. And I think one of the best examples we have of political mobilization was not so much the Women's March in Washington, which I think was very important for progressives and others, but the indivisible mobilization at the town halls of members of Congress, which has saved Obamacare. has saved Obamacare. And that's a perfect illustration of constructive political mobilization. But you need good lawyers, you need political mobilization, and social movements, protest movements, movements on the street, demonstrations are important, but they're only important as an auxiliary to the other two.
Well, I want to add a couple of things, and then we'll go to the phones. One thing is that the overarching assumptions that you make are reformist.
Yes,
that is to make this society, not some other society, better.
That's right.
Okay, so that is not a radical assessment.
That's true.
I just want to, you know.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, Irving Kristol once wrote a book called Two Cheers for Capitalism. I say Two Cheers for Incrementalism.
Yes. So you're a damn reactionary, David. Okay, anyway, and David and I used to, historically, we used to yell at each other in the history department. Well, actually, David didn't. He was very nice, and I would scream down the halls. God knows what people thought. Fortunately, I knew most of the people there. They just thought, oh, you know, acting out again.
Well, you and I have something in common. We both have a certain amount of charm that gets us by when other people might not.
Nobody ever called me charming, but thank you. at any rate, this David and I, our history includes the famous and now very much misunderstood strike, the student strikes that took place after Kent State. And after Jackson State, I think it was
called.
That's
right.
And which was an event undercovered, but it was essentially a murder of African-American students at a school in the South. So, and my position historically was varied, but I went through a stage of kind of naive Marxism, and I was very much influenced by pacifism in my earlier adolescent and late adolescent years, influenced by Dorothy Day and others, and really thought that that was the goal. The ideal goal would be a society that was nonviolent, a society that would give everybody opportunities, etc. A very charming, and I would say, you're going to jump into that, and I would say hopeful idea of America.
Yeah.
Since that time, I've come to believe probably a much darker view. And I'm sorry to say that my predictive capabilities were good. Here we are at what I consider the dawning of a new kind of fascism. And the struggle against that fascism, if it is even at any stage successful, will not yield a good socialist or a social democratic, perhaps more important, change in American society. The best I see for the next few years is an effort to block the taking away of all the things, all the struggle elements that begin with the labor movement back in the 1930s and continue through the struggles of women and persons of color and so on. So I'm kind of scared. I have children, my children have children, you know. It's a real world, and it's really turning very strange that the old Soviet Union should turn into the autocratic Russia, and that Russia should be playing games with us, with our leadership, and that we have a crazy idiot as President of the United States who is backed by very opportunistic capitalists and very naive and stupid fundamentalists who have dominated or tried to dominate American politics since the founding of the country. That's what I think.
Now, I agree with you that this is a moment of defense for people who deem themselves progressives, and even defense of just some of the incremental change that the Obama presidency brought us.
Right.
Which was, I've been very heartened, as I said, by those mobilizations at the congressional town meetings. That's political mobilization. That's going to the heart of political power, confronting these members of Congress with, hey, don't take away the darn healthcare bill, you know,
right.
And they've been intimidated. And it's fascinating to watch the Republicans now, who never had a chance of getting any replacement for Obamacare because they can't agree on what they want, but it's the whole thing's coming apart, and now the White House is lashing out at Paul Ryan. Breitbart News is lashing out at Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan is insisting they're going ahead with this healthcare bill. The White House apparently last night tweeted that there's not 24 million people who will lose health care in the next 10 years, but 26 million. That came from the White House. So it's very bizarre what's going on. But at least the Health Care Act, as faulted and limited as it may be, has been saved.
And people will remember that the reason why Obamacare was created, the compromises that were involved, had to do with the fact that Republicans simply were obstructionists throughout the process of trying to build a health care reform.
Right. And of course, it was a American Enterprise proposal, and Romney supported it in Massachusetts. The mandate is came from the American Enterprise system. There shouldn't be freeloaders in the healthcare system.
Right. And I think it's really it really is important, and it's said often, but it can't be said often enough. The United States is the only modern industrial society without a total coverage of healthcare for everybody. And there has been much study in economics that shows that such a plan, while costly at the tax level, is in fact a very cheap way of dealing with a very expensive phenomenon, which is people desperately needing health care everywhere and not getting it.
And if you don't have it through health insurance, you have it through emergency room courses.
Which is very expensive. Right. So I just wanted to introduce this. We got calls streaming in, and we'll be talking about this for the rest of the show. The idea of American reform versus revolution. The other thing I want to touch on, I hope we get to it, is the phenomenon of people fighting the police. This is not a new thing. This is part of a tradition. The police represent the establishment and frequently are the most reactionary people in the establishment because they're the front line dealing with any attempt to make improvements, but also because...
And they also have a lot of blowback coming at them as part of
their
daily job.
They do, but they also have a lot of weapons, and who the hell becomes a cop these days? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a serious question. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know, I'm sure there probably are some studies of that, but it used to be the case that it was a working class way of rising within the system. And I suspect it still functions at some degree at that level.
Like the military.
Like the military, exactly. Well, they are a military. They're a paramilitary. Yeah. I'm going to argue that fighting the police, while fun, sort of, you know, is kind of a side. You know, it right. doesn't really help anything. Well, blocking traffic all over for working people works maybe one time. But to do it repeatedly ends up alienating the very people you want to persuade.
Well, I mentioned in my presentation in passing that I thought Occupy Wall Street eventually dissolved because it became a matter of fighting over public space, which was not the issue. The issue was the atrocious abuses coming out of the Wall Street financial community, which had precipitated this horrendous recession. And somehow it became whether street people and others have a right to occupy public space or not right. the issue.
No, right. I mean, that's really important. It's really important to understand, in fact, that because of the way the American educational system works and because of the way capitalism itself works, being able to provide for a significant amount of the population a number of luxury services like big screen TVs or whatever, right. There's a large degree of satisfaction, even as anyone with a real moral conscience, whatever their politics, can see that there's something seriously wrong in a society that denies health care, that doesn't give a living wage. In fact, wages in real terms have gone down since the time of the presidency of, well, who would it be first that did that? I guess it would be President...
Nixon.
Yeah, Nixon.
The golden age of the American working class ends in 1973. It's 1945 to 1973, where unionization rates decline, but also wages decline. You know, there's the competition of the global economy, the oil embargo, all this. After 1973, there were spurts, but generally it's a trajectory downward.
Well, I also fix some of the blame on Bill Clinton. And we can talk about that a bunch. Anyway, let's open up the phone lines. I want to hear from people commenting on this or other aspects, ancillary. I love that word, ancillary to this. 231-8187. Who do we got? Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Great discussion. Dr. Horowitz, really great to hear your perspective. You signed off on an undergraduate thesis of mine a couple of years ago, but we never had the chance to meet. I think that reform, I think of Richard Aoki, who was the, now it's kind of coming out that he may have been a CIA operative within the Black Panther Party, who basically gave them their guns. Down in Oakland, but he said reform is like a piece of poop. You can change the shape, but it's still a piece of poop. And so I wonder, you know, if when we look at the principles upon not necessarily the ideals as they're put on paper, but the actual functional principles of the founding of this country, if we're really just reshaping a giant piece of poop. And so I wonder, you know, and it's an open question for me, if revolution is actually the logical thing in our society, because, we have systemic racism upon which capitalism and the accumulation of capitalism is predicated. And so, you know, should we keep pushing this thing forward, or should we really be working locally, regionally, nationally, and internationally to build that other world?
You're assuming that other world is buildable given the conditions of the world and the American society today.
Yeah, well, my analysis is that, you know, this is like the run up before the collapse, that, you know, this mismanagement of this system is really reaching its pinnacle, where we have the ultimate private corporate influence is actually on the inside, hollowing out and you know, I've heard reference to this being a kleptocracy, right? Just taking everything that we can, run this system into the ground. And so what is going to be left over in 4 years for us to be able to even reform, to be able to work with? You know, I think that's a real valid question, not just at the level of the ineptitude of the folks who are running the show, but also because of their real and express agenda and what they intend to do. And so real question that we should start looking to, you know, what's going to be left over. And kind of like Naomi Klein said, right, like these hollowed out industrial cities are really our future. Detroit is our future. And so what comes after, you know, this industrial collapse and abandonment by the capitalist class? I appreciate, Dr. Horowitz, what you said about needing good lawyers and about needing folks on the inside as well as the outside. And I would love to hear you speak a little bit more to how, you know, what that actually looks like and how folks in the past have actually built those networks of solidarity across class lines. Because that sounds like something that anecdotally makes sense to me, and it resonates with me. But I'd wonder if you could give some specific historical examples of like the insider-outsider alliances that really helped to push forward progressive agendas in history.
Thank you for the call. I'm not going to burden David necessarily with that, but it will be. But we'll try to deal with
it. Well, I did talk about the labor movement.
You're right.
Did talk about the women's suffrage movement. Did talk about the early civil rights movement. Those are all examples of sort of cross-class collaboration.
Yeah. No. I think that I mean there used to be. During the period of time of the struggle of Vietnam, where there was clearly growing national sentiment, particularly among young people because of the draft and other things, but there was growing sentiment about the purposelessness and the horror of that war, the viciousness, the meanness, the fact that it was increasingly obvious that it could not be won. The engagement in the Cold War manifested itself in a variety of reactionary revolutions and wars, the destruction of the government of Indonesia being one such example. There are a lot of examples. But the fact of Vietnam, actually where we took on the obligations and the power of the French imperial government post-World War II in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia generally, with a perspective that there was a unified left of China and the Soviet Union, when in fact no such thing existed, except in the largest sense of the idea of socialism. And in fact, we engaged in destroying a lot of our treasure, as it were, in an absolutely in terms of every aspect of warfare, an unwinnable war. If people in the military who theoretically read such texts on military as like Sun Tzu and others, you just look at it and you say, well, this is not a winnable war. It's not a, you can't maintain this basically colonial reactionary system and expect to win. But that was a factor in denial throughout the entire period of the post-war struggle against communism. What it did do, of course, eventually was, and this may have been an intentional tactic by larger minds than us, was rob the Soviet Union of any possibility of success as a system. But of course, it was a very weak system anyway, because it was not, I believe democracy is the strongest way to govern. I personally believe that. And there was no...
Well, you know what Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst possible form of government except for all the others.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So I think I'm going to have more calls because I think that's probably what I ought.
Can I make a point about Vietnam?
Absolutely, man.
There were very powerful establishment figures who opposed the war in Vietnam, including Senator J. William Fulbright, mm-hmm. who, when I read his stuff, when I'm teaching my classes, I'm more and more impressed of how effective he was, and General Gavin and others, and eventually Robert McNamara himself came to oppose the war.
Right. Well, the assumptions and the fictions around the Cold War itself were so inherently and more obviously ineffective and meaningless. So that we were really engaged in a symbolic activity,
right,
killing millions of people in Vietnam and quite a few thousands of Americans.
It was triumph of the will.
Oh, my, my. That's a Nazi reference. Okay, 231-8187. Moose!
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
So far, so good. What's up?
Hey, awesome. I just wanted to kind of mention, as a student of Chomsky's, how important I feel that it is to remain realistic and not let the establishment define what is realistic as we seek to make change. So, for example, just how many arguments Noam has gotten into with his friends over the decades about, say, getting rid of the Pentagon system when he feels like they're not adequately acknowledging the realities of how much we depend on the Pentagon system for our entire technological advancement. And there's obviously people who know a lot more about that than me. And so just another example that kind of comes up to me is how he put out this little YouTube, Noam Chomsky did recently, where he was saying that he was urging Obama, just before he left office, to sign a presidential pardon, a group pardon that would have pardoned all illegal immigrants and made them have legal status and given Trump a hell of a mess to fight right as soon as he got into office. And so just wanted to reiterate that kind of idea of the radical things that we could plausibly do immediately, and also keeping an eye on the ball of what is or isn't really politically realistic. Not letting the establishment define what's politically realistic, uh-huh, but still us looking at it.
Well, thank you. I'm going to let you go, and we're going to respond to that. There's some interesting issues there. One of the things that's happening is that there is actually, through Trump's absolute lack of intelligence and an absolute desire to be the president, as it were, there is the growth of the Breitbart fascist movement. And it's very, it would have been a mild to middle level influence in a structure of argument in American politics, as it was under Obama. What has happened, however, is that these people have been given the keys to the kingdom. And while they make no sense to me or possibly to you out there, they are real. And they are intentional about gutting the apparent bureaucratic system, while at the same time handing all power directly to a supposedly extremely wise capitalist class. Not that there hasn't always been capitalism, I would point out. So, David, you have a comment on that?
I'm not so sure how friendly Breitbart is to capitalism.
I think so. You think it's real fascism?
I think it's self-indulgent authoritarianism.
Okay.
I think it's sort of a feel-good politics
for the right,
certain segment of the population, mainly younger people who feel alienated and without meaning, and I think it fulfills that gap. I think a lot of the antisocial acting out that's been associated, say, with the vandalism against and threats against Jewish community centers.
Yeah, what is that about? Well, I'm just, you don't need to answer that. I'm just saying, what is that about?
I think it's
about?
Similar to the skinheads. It's basically acting out against what these people perceive as political correctness and, you know, the liberal hegemony. It's rather, I don't think it's literally directed at Jews. It's just a way of...
the Jews are a convenient, yeah. as they have been historically, a convenient victim class.
Yeah. Just to act out antisocially and as a sort of a...
Well, and I think a lot of the rage that comes to the street, and this is something that's going to annoy some of you, but the rage that's acted out on the street with a what are you going to call it, mock rioting. I say mock because it ain't real.
Mm-hmm.
Mock rioting that results in arrests that are then the consequences of people get inconvenienced, but the charges are dismissed. Meanwhile, a growing sense of despair, anger, and reaction takes place in people who simply want to get home,
mm-hmm.
for example, when the streets are blocked. I think it's important.
Recently, I picked up a book about the history of anarchism by Alex Butterworth, and there's a section on Prince Kropotkin, who was one of the founders of the anarchist movement, but was a great believer in nonviolence. And he Kropotkin refers to young men who crave the easy adrenaline rush of terrorism, which is what he was talking about in that case, but lack the stamina and dedication for the arduous task of building a broad and popular movement. And that was really a paraphrase of what Kropotkin had told the court in France when he was sentenced to prison for his activities. But it's interesting, that notion of kind of self-indulgent young men acting out, which would apply both to our anarchist friends on the street at protest movements, but mm-hmm. also, I think, to the young men affiliated or influenced by the Breitbart phenomenon.
Well, and I think there's an excitement, which is not unlike the excitement of the fans of the soccer teams, that takes hold of young people. I saw this, the original Black Bloc movement, I saw it take over a couple of major marches here in Portland a few years ago, just simply by getting at the head of it and taking it off. Mm-hmm. And there was no leadership, no real power, no clarity, I would say, of goal in those marches. So it was easy to do.
Right.
And the marches are symbolic of behavior, which may be impressive on television, despite the terrible coverage of local news, may be impressive on television, but in fact do not present a plan or a systemic approach to the problems that are going on. There are lots of signs that suggest lots of things. There are a lot of people with good ideas. But in terms of coherence, there is no clarity of understanding of the structure of power in America and what it really means.
Well, I was saying at the beginning of our discussion that I thought marches and protests and demonstrations are one of the three tools. And they are an auxiliary, I think, to political mobilization itself and to, you know, good lawyers. I thought the Women's March in Portland on January 21st, in which I participated and got the worst cold I've ever had in my life.
Sure, you're right.
I thought it was effective. I thought it was effective in showing a large body of people, 100,000 people or so, who are declaring independence from the new administration in Washington. And the ambience was really, really positive. And literally, I saw people applauding the police and smiling at the police and thanking them. That was a different kind.
Yeah, but you know, that undermines the legitimacy of serious struggle to a great extent. I'm not criticizing the march. I think it was a good thing. But you have to be aware that unless you put forward the actual conflicts and the structure of power in the society and make a critique of it, even in a march, you end up creating an illusion of democracy that is meaningless in the real world.
But sometimes just a mobilization.
Well,
is
just
important.
Getting that feeling.
This was
going.
A counter celebration of
the
inauguration.
Oh yeah, I'm not. Listen, I think it was a great event, yeah. And I really support it. And I, I'm still wishing I had that pussy hat, pussy cap. Katrina, you're on the air.
Good morning. I wanted to know if you thought that there is a validity in the act of not voting, and if there's any pros and cons to the idea behind it, not participating in, you know, the political atmosphere. And that's really all I have to ask, just if you could talk about that a little bit and give me your insights.
I'm completely opposed to the idea of not voting. There are some remarkable statistics which came out of the last presidential election. There were, for example, African Americans in Pennsylvania. There were 130,000 less African American votes for Hillary than there had been for Obama in 2012 in the state of Pennsylvania. Hillary lost Pennsylvania by 44,000 votes. In Wisconsin and Michigan, and this has now been well documented, Jill Stein had more votes than the difference between Trump and Hillary.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yes, yes. Jill Stein had 31,000 votes in Wisconsin. Trump beat Hillary by 23,000. And in Michigan, the third and fourth party votes increased sixfold from 2012, and Hillary lost by 11,000 votes.
Well, and this is, it's really important to understand something that people got very angry with me at when the when Hillary was the inevitable, quote-unquote, candidate after losing in 08. And I have believed that the Democratic Party is really the party of the left establishment, left only in the sense of a division, so that they are the liberaler, and they have not carried out the reforms that were characteristic of the Democratic Party's rise to power and significance in the period prior to World War II, during World War II, and for a while afterward, because it embraced the Civil Rights Movement, for example. So, you know, I really thought the issue of Hillary was taken on as a kind of politics of giving women a chance, making an assumption, which I have never believed, by the way, that women are somehow in our culture inherently wiser and better suited to being the governors of the society. My feeling is that whatever truth there is in that is canceled by the process of bringing people to power to the position where they could be significant struggle figures. So I have been dubious about politics in our society that is based upon class solely, or race solely, or sex solely. I think that's a very dangerous assumption set. And there's no real reason, no real historical reason, to expect that it has a extremely and overwhelming value. And the Democratic Party did a terrible thing in trying to stop Bernie. And I don't know that Bernie could have defeated Trump, but it would have mobilized large numbers of people. The fact that Hillary and her people didn't go to Wisconsin, didn't go to Michigan, didn't go to the places where they needed to be, where there was a strong and angry industrial working class who were disenfranchised.
That's a tactical error.
Oh, terrible tactical error. Anyway, I think we should go back to the phones. 231-8187. Mark.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call and for your erudite discussion. There was an article on Facebook that said Paul Ryan's free market argument for repealing Obamacare is delusional nonsense. I think we are witnesses to the implosion of the political parties and to the indoctrination of neoliberalism. It's an ideology that became a quasi-natural mystification, the concentration on market and competition. What we need is system change, not climate change. And to me, the 26 community centers in Vancouver, Canada, offer a great example of a third authority, you know, beyond the state and the market.
I don't know about them. Can you briefly explain them?
Well, the Carnegie Community Center in the poorest part of Vancouver is open from 9 to 11. That is almost all the time. And you can use the computers for 3 hours a day. There are casserole dinners for $3.50. There is a game room, a TV room, a gym, a theater. It's really quite spectacular.
So you're talking about a system of organized effort that allows for politics to develop indigenously? Is that the idea?
Well, the idea is that people gain joy and a sense of community, whether they're workers or non-workers, through the community center phenomenon. And it's a great investment. It has a multiplier and a cushioning effect. And we seem to make alternatives taboo. You know,
well, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, just as you never hear or read about Canada in the mass media. You don't really hear about alternatives, and
that's certainly true.
And of course, pluralistic thinking in economics. This is really a vital necessity as we are going over the cliff. I happened to upload a great article this morning titled "Without Social Democracy, Capitalism Will Eat Itself," by Karen Peterson, and it's found on socialeurope.eu. So it's from February. So I recommend it. I think without the social contract, we become wolves against one another. And that's my perspective. I thank you for your passion.
I'm glad you called. Thank you. David, do you have a response there?
I think what you say about cooperative movements at the grassroots is tremendously important. I mean, one of the most important things for the survival of any hope is the psychic survival of our local communities. And I think that's an essential. But I still don't see any substitute to national politics, because basically the direction of the country is decided through national politics, and we have a system of elections that can be highly faulted, obviously, because of the influence of money. It's a monetary democracy in many ways. But still, ultimately, people vote. People vote for their congressional representatives. Mm-hmm. And we do have periodic elections. And that basically helps to determine the way in which the society moves forward or does not move forward. I used Barack Obama's commencement speech at Howard University as part of my text when I delivered this presentation to this protest panel. And it was talking, obviously, to students at a historically African-American university. Democracy requires compromises, he said, even when you are 100% right. This is hard to explain. You can be completely right, and still you're going to have to engage folks who disagree with you. If you think the only way forward is to be as uncompromising as possible, you'll feel good about yourself. You will enjoy a certain moral purity, but you're not going to get what you want. And if you don't get what you want long enough, you will eventually think the whole system is rigged, and that will lead to more cynicism.
But the whole system is rigged. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And less participation in a downward spiral of more injustice and more anger and more despair. And then he says, you know what? I will take better every time. I always tell my staff, better is good, because you consolidate your gains and then you move on to the next fight from a stronger position.
Well, see, I'm extremely critical of the Obama administration, having missed many opportunities, having not been willing to take a more radical or fundamental, I think is a better word, stand on various things, and in fact being absolutely unclear about the question of what sort of economic system we ought to be striving for. So, you know, we have a real clash of liberalism, I guess it is, versus from a more radical point of view.
Well, the Obama administration was dealt the cards of a rather hostile political environment.
I think Obama's
the question of free trade is one that is going to haunt progressives one way or the other. It almost has no positive solutions. We have an economy that is so geared to the global the global marketplace that to disentangle from it, like repealing Obamacare, could bring worse repercussions than living with it. It's a very difficult problem for progressives. I don't have an answer myself, but it's one that is really dissecting people who consider themselves progressives, the relationship of this economy to the global economy.
Well, and that is a problem, but also I really honestly believe that the whole structure of education and the culture has now become totally filled with assumptions of the legitimacy of monopoly capital. And because that's so, it's really hard to imagine for a large number of Americans, an alternative system that would work, providing both opportunity and security. And that's really, really, really becoming more and more clear to me, at least.
Well, you know, I have these discussions with my colleagues in the history department at Portland State, who are very much opposed to free trade and NAFTA. Well, not free trade in principle, but the way the trade agreements have worked out. But, you know, I point out that, and to many of my students too, but I point out that our fascination with all the high-tech gadgets and our fascination with apps and all of this is built as part of this capitalist system, and mm-hmm. somehow people want to do away with capitalism, but they kind of want these technological innovations that enhance their lives. And there's a real contradiction here.
Yeah, but here's where you and I probably disagree. I see, this is not an answer, but I see in the reasonable success of social democracy in Europe a solution. Capitalism obviously dominates. A lot of bad, I would say, bad decisions and bad activities take place within that system. But at the same time, although this is now being more and more challenged, at the same time, good schools, good housing, good health care, and so on are entirely possible. And I sound a little too liberal here, maybe, but they're entirely possible under a system that accommodates to capitalism, but ensures ordinary people a living wage and a living life, as it were.
I couldn't agree more.
So, and of course, what's happened here in this country is it's an either or. With a demon of communism, or whatever the modern term for that is, constantly being used as a device to control behavior and control politics.
It was funny. Bernie Sanders was with Chris Hayes in Charleston, West Virginia last night.
I saw that actually.
Yeah, it was interesting. These people wanted single payer health care. They believed it was a right of people to have health care. Mm-hmm. They wanted infrastructure development. Mm-hmm. Seemed very sympathetic to Bernie Sanders. He seemed to speak to.
I think he actually could have won the presidency. I actually think that. No, people say, "Oh, then they would have red baited him and so on." I think he could have handled that. I think his campaign would have been built around social justice issues for ordinary people, and it would have probably brought enough voters out to wipe out the insane mythology that surrounded Trump.
One of the problems, I think, of running someone who has a program that attracts a lot of attention is what I call the Netanyahu factor. In that last Israeli election, Palestinians were mobilizing to vote in the Israeli election, Palestinians in Jerusalem and elsewhere, to an unprecedented degree. And Netanyahu used that to call out the Likud vote.
To scare the hell out of people.
The Arabs are coming. So that there's there's a blowback. There's always a blowback.
Right.
You know, you have to consider that when you run a particular candidate or you have a particular movement. You may mobilize the other side.
So if I understand, if there is a serious disagreement between us, there may be at the far end what society ought to be. But ignoring that, what you're really arguing is a strategy which is pretty conservative, which is to envelop the right wing with a good, moderate social democracy argument. Is that fair to say?
I guess incremental reform.
Okay.
Of the next 4 years, a defense of advances that we've already achieved. I see it purely as a defensive posture, unfortunately, at this time.
Well, and one of the weirdest things was the peculiar charisma of Trump. a man who obviously doesn't read anything, a man who obviously doesn't know anything, a man who obviously doesn't care about anything but himself and his family. And to me, watching him just through the whole process was bizarre, because he had so much support from people who, based on their class situation, based on their income situation, based on all kinds of stuff.
Many Obama of voters from last time supported.
They should not have done that. And they did not. The cynicism is the assumption that government is totally screwed anyway. Let's just
blow it up.
That
was it.
Well, it's being blown up.
Yep.
So we'll see. But I don't have a great deal of hope at this point. Most people actually are not conscious voters. And many people are not voters at all. So the system falls apart at the level of the ballot box. That's what I think.
Well, conservatives always have a policy of disillusioning progressives and keeping them from voting, not with the coercive methods, which is another subject.
Right.
But by simply
saying,
disillusioning.
Forget it, buddy.
Yeah, yeah. You can't get anything done anyhow.
Right. And I think this is a very serious situation. And I want to mention one thing that's really important in this conversation. While we may engage intellectually in this argument, while we may talk about what ought to be, an onrushing reality, as Naomi Klein said in writing This Changes Everything, an onrushing reality is that the environment is crumbling as a consequence in large part of human behavior. We're seeing storms. The way the weather is reported ignores the changes that are obviously taking place. And, in fact, when you spend billions on a wall at the Mexican border.
They're not going to spend it.
It's not going to happen, I agree. But when you offer that and when you argue for it, and you ignore the fact that we are the only modern industrial society that doesn't have high-speed rail, that doesn't have all kinds of things, good, healthy water, all kinds of stuff.
That's an incremental list reform, by the way.
Yeah, it is. But the fact of the matter is that these things could be built, could have been built, and should be built, and they're not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because even though we're not going to probably be able to afford or be able to accomplish the stupid wall, it is going to drive away and a wedge away from services that could be provided by the government. The biggest problem of capitalism at this point, I think, is greed. So the simple fact that I have $7 million, but I want 17. Mm-hmm. And that is really significant. Let's go back to the phones. Francis.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you guys have talked about it a lot. As far as the corporate industry goes, there's plenty of... Corporations aren't people, as we've discussed before, and the only conscience of a corporation is short-term profit. So there's never going to be enough. And this current president, while we're all talking about this crazy... some sort of framework of a health plan that the Congress has put forward, has proposed increasing the military spending outrageously, and an outrageous amount of money. And if that is the case, any money that is spent on these war toys is could have been used for health, just for single payer or whatever.
Well, there's a tremendous waste.
I agree that Bernie Sanders would have won handily, because he was able to, you know, we're talking about intersectionalism right now. He was able to bring all the issues about in a form and a way that people could see how everybody's being oppressed. And as long as there is oppression, we don't really need to compromise much. I believe that Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated not because of the civil rights movement, but because of his discussions about the Vietnam War and about the war economy and how poor people are being oppressed. And he was bringing it all together.
That's why he was murdered, I think.
Exactly. And that's what the common people right now, the ones who voted for Trump and who are going to get screwed by this health insurance plan, need to understand that, you know, this hate and this fear of others is just a way to perpetuate this continual war economy, which is making bank for these corporations. And I agree that we need attorneys to protect voters' rights, for one thing, but also for some way to finally try to figure out a way to where we the people, an individual person, can demand the protections that corporations are getting
under
the 14th Amendment.
We're running out of time, and I wanted to give
David... All right, you guys take care.
Thank you. I wanted to give David a last word.
I just had two phrases of assurance. One, the health care bill is dead. Two, Lindsey Graham has said that Trump's budget, including the defense spending, is dead on arrival.
Well, that is interesting. I hope it's true. Listen, we're pretty much out of time, and I want to thank you all. I didn't get a chance to read the promos, but the fact of the matter is this is the best radio station in the city, and it has the best music, and I always say that because I'm really proud of our music programming, as well as our public affairs programming. And you all stay tuned, and we'll see you all. And David, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe. It's been fun.
I'll be right back.
KABU Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KABU 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kabu.fm/kabuair2017. KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Golda's Balcony, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from March 10th through April 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Golda's Balcony is the final